Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial, bringing new ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more creatively positive mind. And it's a party down here at the studio today, let me tell you. We have in the studio with us three great people. Okay, we have Dr. Shelley Carson, psychologist who has been studying creativity, the creative brain, many ways that you could look at the creative brain and how we could understand our own creativity with us. And also in the studio with me, good friend and associate, Dr. William Peter Astwood, who himself has been psychologist to many creative people and has a lot of thoughts on it, but he was curious. He saw the book by Shelley Carson. He said, hey, I'd like to sit in on that. And then no less than Dr. Kent Robert Shaw himself, psychiatrist, who treats the movie stars and other people, lesser than or soon to be movie stars, is with us today. So first, let's start. Shelley, welcome to WBAI.
Hi, Armand. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Yeah, and Kent, thanks for being here. And Bill.
Always a pleasure.
Certainly is.
Here we go. We got three great voices. So let's start off with Shelley and this whole idea of the creative brain. Shelley, what have you learned that we don't know?
Well, one of the findings in the neuroscience of creativity is that highly creative individuals activate certain neural patterns when they're working on creative activities that other people tend not to activate. So my idea is that if you can mimic these brain activation patterns, you can hone your own creative abilities.
What part of the brain is being used that we're not used to? Is it in the hypothalamus, in the amygdala? Is it in the anterior cingulate gyrus? Where might it be?
Well, creativity doesn't have a specific home in the brain. You basically use the entire brain throughout the creative process. But creativity is a messy process. It has several different stages. So our goal is to activate the brain in the best, most efficient way, depending upon the stage of the creative process that you're in.
All the world's a stage. That was the joke. Well, what stages of creative process are there, might I ask?
Graham Wallace, way back in 1926, identified several stages of the creative process. And what's interesting is that highly creative people ever since then have tended to attest to these same stages. So the first one is a part called preparation. Preparation includes gathering knowledge, specific skills, and identifying a specific creative problem. Then after that, you try to find a solution to your creative problem. Many times you can do that directly just by reasoning it out, trial and error, but other times you have to let it incubate. And then later on, a creative insight comes to you. After that, you need to evaluate that creative idea, that insight, and implement it.
So if I see a baby sitting with some mud, they don't think about it. They take the mud and they do something with it, and suddenly they turn it into the most beautiful combination of a pelican and a dolphin. And you look at it and say, gee, look at that. I've never seen that before. So now the child has been creative, but have they gone through four steps? Or maybe that's not creativity.
Well, it depends on what they produce. If we're just looking at scribblings of a toddler that's just learning to hold a crayon, we may not consider it creative. Even though it's original, it may not be creative.
Ah, okay, good difference.
Mm-hmm.
So creative in itself, by your definition, requires forethought?
Not necessarily forethought, but let me give you my definition of creativity, and then we can go from there. And this is, by the way, also a definition of creativity that's espoused by most of the research community. In order to be creative, something has to have two different factors. The first is be original and novel, and the second is it has to be adaptive or useful in some way. In other words, it has to serve a purpose. So my personal definition is that creativity is the act of taking bits of information whether you gather them from the environment or from your own internal store of memories and knowledge and skills, and combine them and recombine them in novel and original ways to solve a problem or to be purposeful.
Well, what you're saying that's a little different is that the combination is the original process, not the stuff itself is not original, because nothing's really original. Everything is just an amalgam or a synthesis, isn't it?
So they say nothing new since the Greeks, right?
Is that what they say?
That's what they say.
That's what they say. So what we're saying is that it may not be new material, because if you have a new color, for example, that we're now going to sell. Ralph Lauren is selling this color called Seascape Blue, right? And it's not a new color. It's a synthesis. It's a changing. It's kind of mixing other things together in a different kind of way.
Well, if you want to go way back to the beginning, back to caveman days, everything that was novel and original was a combination of what was already out there. So we're always building on pieces of things that are already there.
So for somebody to really scour their brain and say, I've got to create this piece of music. Well, let me ask this to Kent. Mm-hmm. Kent, you've written music, you've done music, you play music. Do you ever sit there in agony and say, oh, how do I get this creative thing going? Bill, you've been with people who have been creative. Do they ever sit there and look at the canvas? I know you've worked with some artists. Look at the canvas and say, how do I get this to become something special?
Well, I think, trying to combine different ideas that don't seem to naturally go together is one of the things I've seen with people, creative musicians and the like, where it's so easy, I assume, to just go to the rote memories and the tunes and the chord changes you already know. And I sort of remember reading the person who wrote the music for The Exorcist, the Tubular Bells, again, the rock and roll, and trying to come up with rock and roll ideas. And then he had the idea of classical music and bells, and started with that idea, which at the surface is very, doesn't go well together. But over time, working out classical music, rock music, there was all these different combinations, and came up with the classic theme for The Exorcist, which was a kind of a hybrid between the two.
Well, one of the things that struck me is that there seems to be different styles of creativity. There's spontaneous creativity, which is people doing things spontaneously because it's interesting and fun and to fill the time. And then there are people who are creative for a living, where it's a lifelong task. And for them, it's very much a beginning, middle, and end, a very involved process. There's a lot of intent involved. And often, it seems to be attached to a kind of direct connection to dreams and childhood and to the simpler aspects of us, the less organized aspects.
Well, that's very interesting. What do you think?
Well, I actually talk about two different pathways to creativity in the book, the deliberate and the spontaneous pathways. So I think that addresses what you were just saying, Bill.
Well, expound on that. By the way, the name of the book is Your Creative Brain. Shelley Carson, Dr. Shelley Carson, CARSON, Harvard Health Publications, because she went to Harvard.
And I don't want to take credit for discovering the deliberate and the spontaneous pathways. I'm working off of some work that was done by Arnie Dietrich at American University in Beirut, who identified pathways in the brain, specific pathways in the brain that are associated with spontaneous creativity. And this would be the kind of creativity that just kind of pops into your mind. And I think you were alluding to that earlier. So the type that pops into your mind, nevertheless, there is a preparation phase for that. Even if you're a young child, everything that you've learned prior to is being used by the brain to come up with these new creative ideas. And remember what Pasteur said, that chance favors the prepared mind. So the better you prepare your mind, the more likely it is you will come up with both spontaneous and deliberate creative works.
Chance
favors the prepared mind.
I didn't know Pasteur said. I thought he said the milk is going to go bad. so what advice do you have for people who are struggling with their creativity related to this particular issue? I mean, what did you find? How do you think people could really help themselves? You know, you've got these seven steps.
Well, my particular work has looked at cognitive disinhibition and creativity.
All right, so this let's go with that.
Okay.
What is cognitive disinhibition?
Cognitive disinhibition is the ability to kind of turn down the mental filters that control how much information makes it into conscious awareness. So what we know is that unless there's some sort of serious brain damage, our brains are working constantly. And the more rearward parts of the brain in the parietal, occipital, and temporal lobes are always going through a pattern matching process. What you want to be able to do is allow more of that information to feed forward into conscious awareness. And the way that you can do that is to disinhibit certain parts of your brain. You want to defocus the attention in the prefrontal cortex, for instance. That will allow a greater variety of information to come forward so that it's consciously available to you.
How could you be so specific? I mean, you get that part of your brain drunk or something?
Well, you know, people have been using drink many centuries.
People have used alcohol for years for creative purposes.
Exactly.
You think that's what it does? You think from what we've seen that maybe the disinhibitory factor of alcohol?
Well, we do know that alcohol and certain other types of drugs as well are disinhibitory. But we don't want everybody ending up dancing on the tables with lampshades on their head either.
But most of the people I know who smoked marijuana back in the days when I was hanging around with people who did such things, you would see, and they thought they were being tremendously creative, and their stuff was lousy. I mean, they just thought it was creative, but it didn't sound very good. So I think what it disinhibits is your ear for good music.
It may disinhibit your ability to evaluate later on, too.
Yeah.
So not all creative ideas are good creative ideas.
You know, one of the things I noticed, Shelley, I was looking at one of these TV shows about creating, you know, trying to find your next talent. And a lot of kids who come on who try to perform, they get on there and they do a performance and they're terrible at it. But what they've done is practiced in their basement by themselves for week after week after week, and they've had no feedback. How important is transient feedback to the creative process?
Well, I think that criticism can be very valuable to the creative process, especially for this reason. Lots of times when we have these spontaneous insights about what's creative to us, they come into our mind with a real sense of conviction. You know, when something pops into your head, it almost feels like it's thought insertion. Like it's come to you from outside of your own brain. So, for instance, we look at people like Schumann, who the composer who believed that his symphonies were being dictated to him by Mendelssohn and Beethoven from their tombs. Or I had one of the subjects in one of my creativity studies was a songwriter, a very famous songwriter. And when I asked her about her creative process, she said, "Oh, I don't create the songs. The angels create the songs. And on good days, I can stick up my antenna and pull the songs in. And the angels allow me to do certain changes in the words, but I can't change the melody. So when I get the song, I hurry to my agent so we can get it copyrighted so that no one else can pull that song in." But what I'm saying is, it seems like these things are coming to you almost from outside of yourself because they arrive in conscious awareness fully formed. And that gives you this very strong conviction that they must be right. Well, sometimes you just need the evaluation of someone outside yourself to let you know whether it's good or not good stuff.
Well, one of the things that I noticed in hanging out of my son's school when he was in second, third, fourth, fifth grade, there's a well-known phenomenon that all young children draw and paint very spontaneously, energetically, and without much thought. But around 8 or 9, most stop, and only a handful continue. And it seemed to me that what was going on is they reached an age where they started to worry about what other people would think about what they were producing, whether it was good enough or not. And that, I think, is the inhibitory thing that we're talking about,
the judgment of others. Therefore, the disinhibitory factor may be disinhibiting the criticism. That might be what we're looking for. Disinhibiting the criticism may be an active part of the brain. What do you think, Shelley?
Well, I do think that disinhibitory processes are involved when we're generating creative ideas. But then you have to be able to evaluate them, and the criticism has to be able to come in at a later point in the process. There's a couple of things I'd like to say about the children, though, if I could. And I think sometimes our school systems get a bad rap for destroying creativity in individuals. But at the same time that it looks like kids are stopping their spontaneous creative stuff, first of all, yes, it's true they are becoming more aware of criticism from outside themselves. But the second thing is that the prefrontal cortex, which is actually the executive center of the brain, is developing. And as it develops, it wants more control over what's going on inside the brain. And so as it starts to develop, it is inhibiting. It's exerting more and more of an inhibitory influence. And this is basically just part of the developmental process.
Can you tell us other parts of the developmental process as you get older?
Well, the big thing that isn't fully developed when children are young is the prefrontal cortex. That's the last part of the brain to develop. And that has our executive functions in it, like being able to plan ahead and being able to think sequentially and logically, and also being able to envision the future. But it also exercises judgment.
Armand DeMille here with you with The Positive Mind. We're with Dr. Shelley Carson, Dr. Kent Robert Shore, and Dr. William Aswood. Is there a doctor in the house? There is one, certainly. Your creative brain. Okay, so what have we learned from neuropsychology? What have we learned? We've imaged the brain now. Now we see parts of the brain all light up in different sequences. Is there something that is more related to creativity than something else? Do we want the hypothalamus active or inactive? Do we know different things? I mean, you said all parts are active. But is there a little red heat somewhere in one particular part as opposed to other?
Well, remember that the latest findings in neuroscience suggest that particular functions don't have very specific locations in the brain. Every part of the brain is connected to every other part of the brain. So basically what we're looking at is different functions light up different networks across the brain. And it's not just that part A and part B are lighting up, but the connections between them are lighting up.
Well, that's good, especially around what they've done with trying to learn about drugs for depression. They found that, you know, it's the different aspects of the brain that are working, not just one particular part. Because with one part, the old prefrontal lobotomy would work, but it doesn't. It doesn't. Kent, what do you think?
Well, I think that this idea that part of the inhibition that people have is a kind of a sensor about their creative process, I think is one of the ways people do tap into their creativity. They somewhat, you know, again, what I think is the writer's block or the way that people don't allow themselves to come up with novel ideas and experiment with an idea that this is stupid, this is trite, this won't work, and then they get stymied and they stop the creative process. So I think it is true. And I do think, you know, I think five of the Nobel Prize winning writers in America, or Pulitzer Prize winning writers, were all alcoholic. And my work with alcoholics in recovery is they'll say that they'll often feel quite inhibited. They'll feel nothing is very interesting. They'll feel stifled about the creative process because they're doing too much of a preemptive judge and preemptive critiquing and not allowing themselves to flow and make mistakes. And from those mistakes will come the creative genius.
I agree with that. And it is amazing, isn't it, that so many of our American novelists have had problems with alcoholism. As you said, five out of the eight Nobel Prize winners, plus a whole slew of those who didn't win Nobel Prizes. So I know that as a writer myself, now I haven't actually used alcohol as a call to my muse, but I've been tempted a few times when you're sitting there looking at the blank paper. And what all of us have to remember is when you sit there and you look at the blank paper, you try to focus harder, and defocusing is what you need to do to get that flow going.
Yeah, one of the things that strikes me, my wife teaches painting, drawing and painting at the Art Students League and the National Academy here in New York. And to me, one of the prime issues about creativity is submitting to instruction and learning, being able to learn how to focus your creativity and to gain the skills from others that allow you to sharpen and make it better and better. And I was wondering if anything in your research addressed the issue of listening to others rather than being creative purely in your own sense, in your own way, and not learning skills.
Well, it's interesting. Talent is different from creativity. So talent is technical ability in a specific area of creative that we would consider a creative endeavor. And often that shows up very, very early in life. We talk about child prodigies or people that are just very, very good early in life at, say, music or art or mathematics, for instance. So talent is a technical ability, and that takes a lot of training, but some people develop talents early on. What's really surprising, though, is if we look at the results of people who were child prodigies and who were had great technical ability very early on, very few of them actually, perhaps Mozart would be one of the big exceptions, have become what we call high C creatives later in life. That is, that they do field-changing or paradigm-changing work in their particular domain of creativity. So being able to find a mentor to help you develop technical skills is an important part of the creative process. However, it's also the case that highly creative people tend to have very big egos, even from early on. And if you think about it, you have to, because creativity involves change. People are naturally resistant to change, and people know that if they perform a change, as in creative work, they're going to get criticized for it. So you have to be pretty sure of yourself, even maybe a little grandiose.
Well, what about finding a mentor? What about it? I mean, when I was a kid, I wanted to learn photography, so I mm-hmm. ran into this guy. His name was Norman Rothschild. He's one of the most famous photographers in the world ever, and I remember seeing this guy walked around, and I said, listen, I'll carry your bags. I'll never open my mouth. Can I follow you around? And he said, sure. And of course, he taught me everything. But it was feeling like, you know, I had something to offer. How do you find a mentor if you're not going to do it for money? What do you do? Who do you trust? Do you find somebody you admire?
I would say finding somebody you might admire is a good idea. There are a lot of community resources for people who are interested in learning about different types of creativity, and a lot of highly creative people also volunteer their time to be mentors for other people, especially if they've seen that they do have talent. Another way you can do it is just expose yourself to highly creative work. And I think this is, sorry to say expose yourself on the radio, but be sure that you are exposed to good work in the field in which you want to work. Go to museums, go to concerts, read the best books. Many people are self-taught. Many highly creative people are self-taught. It's great if you can find a mentor, but you can also learn a lot on your own by studying the great masters.
Well, you know, some of the problem that people very often have is they have such problems with their parents, with any kind of authorities, that they close themselves off, and they're almost like, I'm going to be the star regardless of everybody. But if you get out into this world and you have war with authorities, your creativity is never going to be heard. I mean, nobody's going to want to carry you. Nobody's going to want to play your music. Somehow you got to settle your inner turmoil, I think, in order to be successfully creative, do you? Or do you think you could be as wacky as you want to be and be successfully creative?
Well, that's a really good question. As we know from reading the biographies of famous people, a lot of creative luminaries, both past and present, had some, they had a lot of struggles with inner demons and a lot of personality problems as well. So, Kent, you've worked with highly creative people, and I'm sure that you've run into a few that were a little difficult to get along with.
Yeah, I think that aspect of what you mentioned about grandiosity and feeling superior, it's true that creativity, if you think about it, or I thought about, really, who creates? God creates, and women create. I mean, there's a whole idea that men can go through their life without the idea, without having to create anything, and because women create, you know, a baby, and you know, God creates everything, so that there's this ache to be able to want to create, and that's really stretching yourself to say I can create something new that's never been there before.
So I think you have to have a little bit of ego. In fact, that's one of the personality characteristics that have been noted in highly creative people.
Well, I think one of the personality characteristics that I've seen in every highly creative person is basically they're bipolar too. You know, I mean, you've basically got to have, I think people buy energy and people want energy. If you get to watch TV, you want somebody to energize you. That's why there are no programs teaching meditation on prime time, you know, because you want energy. And you want to hear energy coming through your radio. You want to hear energy coming out of your TV. You want to see energy in the theater and in the films. You want energy coming your way. Because I think people lose their energy. I think it gets sapped like the serotonin. You know, it kind of gets washed away. And you're looking to recharge it somehow. So when you get people, who has the most energy? Manic people. They're terrific energy. You know, it's more and more up there. And that who usually runs the list of successful people, with a few exceptions, like Sharon Sprung, this great artist, who is not of a manic energy, but she has this kind of laid-back, beautiful attitude, but everybody has discovered. People like that, but those are the few. The ones who really get out there are the ones with the highest energy. You think like this manic kind of thing is almost an essential element?
Well, I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Kay Redfield Jamison.
No.
But she's a psychologist. She's also a therapist and is herself bipolar. And she's identified a number of highly creative luminaries from the past that she believes were bipolar. And she also talks about in a book that she wrote called Touched with Fire, some of the characteristics of being hypomanic that contribute to creativity. And it's not just energy. I mean, the lack of sleep that is needed. So people that are hypomanic can often go for a week with 2 or 3 hours of sleep a night and still feel completely energetic. They also have this sense of grandiosity we were talking about. And they also have a broad activation of associational networks in the brain.
Oh, what does that mean? Broad activation of associative networks.
So everything that you learn is part of an associational network. And when one network starts activating another, starts activating another, starts activating another, it's what actually happens when you're in a manic or hypomanic state. One idea suggests another and another and another and another, and it's called the flight of ideas. And this part of hypomania does seem very important in creativity. You don't have to be hypomanic, but the research has indicated that when you are in an elevated mood state, or when your mood goes from a lower mood state to a higher mood state, a happier mood state, this is when your brain becomes more expansive. You have this defocused attention that I was talking about earlier. And Kay Redfield Jamison's work suggests that this can happen either when you're in a depressed state and you're moving toward a normal state, or you're in a normal state moving toward a hypomanic state. But this increase in mood, this elevation in mood, is associated with more idea generation.
How about the opposite of that, the decrease? Could you be saying, oh, you're headed for the pits?
Well, what Jamison also says is what mania creates, depression edits. So when you're heading down toward the pits, that's when you're a better editor of your work or a better evaluator, and you can determine whether it's good or not worth anything.
We're going to take a short break. play you a little music, and when we come back, we'll continue with our discussion.
I made a small, small song. I made a small, small song. I sang it all night long, all through the wind and rain, until the morning came. This song is my small song. This song is my small song. I sang it all night long, and when the morning came, I had to start all over again. My song is so, so my song is so, so small. I could get down and crawl, searching from wall to wall, and ever see anything at all. How could you hurt such a small you hate such a small song? If I was right, I would be wrong. Don't be afraid, it's just a small.
Friends, this is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. Having been a little under the weather, as we all have, huh? Well, help us with our recovery. Go to WBAI.org and help us by joining the Buddy System. The more people we have on a recurrent basis giving money to the station, the less we'll have to have fund drives. Help us cut down on those and we'll do what we can for you. WBAI.org, Buddy. Make a difference.
You are listening to The Positive Mind with Armand DeMille on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City.
A good friend of mine, Peter Hogan, once said, depression is an attempt, a manipulation that failed. Now, that's very interesting when you think about that with manic, because what is mania but an attempt to manipulate everything, all of the factors, so that you could feel better? And you're trying to do it through your creativity or do it through anything. And whenever you fail at that in any way, the other side of it is this deep depression because the manipulation didn't work. It's an interesting concept. We're going to, the next step, of course, Shelley, is the big one. Because when they put out your beautiful book, The Creative Brain, which I could recommend to people because Harvard Health Publications, it's a good study of it, but this is what really counts. Because they do anything to sell a book, you know what I mean? And it says, if you buy this book, you will live longer. It doesn't say that, but it suggests it. But it says you're going to find a mate. Now, I got, this is Shelley. For the people out there who have been saying to me, how do I find a mate? Shelley says, use this book. What do you mean? I mean, take the book and hit somebody over there. How do you use your concept of this and the studies you've had to find a mate?
Well, first of all,
and was that the editor's idea? Was that the?
I don't want to tell everybody that this is that the main purpose of the book is to go out and find a mate. But what I do relate in the book is some recent research that's been done both by Jeff Miller and by Dan Nettles, who is a researcher in England. And both of them have found that people, especially female undergraduates, tend to be attracted to people who are highly creative. In fact, in one study, female undergraduates preferred mate selection of someone who was creative over somebody who was incredibly rich or incredibly wealthy. So creative ability is preferred over wealth. And the reason, the evolutionary reason suggested is that, you know, if you think back to our development as a species, we really owe our ability to be here to our creativity. We aren't fast enough to run away from predators. We're not strong enough to fight off the many animal predators we've had. The one way we've survived as a species is through our ingenuity and our creativity. And so some evolutionary psychologists have suggested that signs of creativity are also fitness indicators, and people pick their mates on the basis of fitness indicators. Highly creative people do tend to be sexually attractive to other people.
So the guy who did the paintings on the walls that we all saw many hundreds and thousands of years later, he was getting a lot. He had a lot of women attracted to him.
He could have been your great-great-grandfather.
Right, could have been. So this thing about having that, you say also, I think one of the important things, and I know all four of you, three of you, I was being creative, would agree with this, that creativity is probably one of the best tools that you could use for developing your relationship with your children. And I'd like to know about what role creativity plays in a relationship with your children.
Well, I think that in this rapid change climate of the 21st century, it's really important that you use your creativity skills when you're dealing with your children. It's very difficult to be the guiding influence in a life that where the kid is got earphones stuck in their ear, they're texting, and they are on email and the internet 24/7. So you know they're getting influences from a lot of other areas. So how can you get through to this mind, and how can you be the number one influence in their life? You need to use your creativity to do this.
How do you do that?
Well, there's...
What do you do? You get a Wii board and you do it with them, or what do you do?
Well, there's a few suggestions I could make, and these aren't necessarily creative suggestions, but one thing you can do is encourage fantasy play rather than having them sitting in front of the television for 7 or 8 hours a day. I know that modern parents use the television as a babysitter, but your children should really be out there engaging in fantasy and imaginative play, role-playing, etc. And that's much better for the development of their later creativity. Unplug them. And by the way, I recommend to everybody out there that you unplug yourself for at least a few hours a day, because the brain can't synthesize and digest and reflect the way it needs to in order for you to be creative if you are spending all your spare time texting other people and following your 1,000 or so people on Twitter.
Well, getting unplugged is real important, right? I mean, nowadays, it's almost like, how could I? How could I live without my cell phone?
And we're addicted to it, getting back to the addiction issue.
I think it's what we should say is that, you know, even though we're saying creativity is so wonderful and pushes, you know, thoughts forward and the like, there's still, I think, a part of all of us that likes the familiar, that likes to go with the routine. You know, again, it's great to talk about creative movies we all love, but if I see another buddy movie, you know, where there's one cop who's conservative, so there does seem to be a part of us that gravitates or can easily gravitate to what's familiar and safe. And so creativity seems to be a struggle somewhat against that, taking a risk and something that's a little unfamiliar.
Can we go back to old-fashioned biology and talk about approach versus avoidance mechanisms? All or most organisms have approach and avoidance mechanisms. So our desire for the familiar and the safe is part of our avoidance mechanism. We want to avoid anything that might be dangerous or risky. And our approach mechanism is really the part of us that's activated when we're creative. We want to get out there. We want to be open to new ideas and really explore our environment.
Well, I think in terms of children having a positive influence, non-cyber positive influence, is setting up a lot of different things to do, putting them in different environments, taking them places, introducing them to new experiences, and not necessarily, you know, forcing piano lessons down their throat, but at least give them a wide variety of different experiences to make choices from, and not just the computer and the TV.
You know, Shelley, one of the questions that I had as well, thank you, Bill. It's Dr. William Aswood, by the way. One of the questions that I had as well is there a difference in the sexes between creativity and the non-creative? Or who is more creatively productive, men or women? And now I know that this is a loaded subject, but if I would look at the numbers of who sells the most stuff, it's going to be men, right? Now, it doesn't mean that they're necessarily more creative, but could it possibly be that the creative gene goes along with testosterone or something?
Well, testosterone does have a lot to do with how the brain's formed. And testosterone is actually important in what we call the lateralization of the brain. So men are more lateralized, and what that means is their left brain is more specialized for language and their right brain is more specialized for visuospatial skills. In women, the brain is less lateralized, so they have a little bit of those skills on either side. But you did ask a loaded question.
Yep, absolutely.
And one of the things that I think is interesting is that if we look at the great creative achievements across history, only about 3% of them have been contributed by women. And what are the reasons for that? Are there genetic differences? Are men just naturally more creative than women? Or are there socialization differences? And I can see different ways to answer that question. So first of all, women are socialized to be less autonomous and more interactive with other people. So that's very important for women. They are affiliative, which means that they are concerned about forging good relationships with other people. But our men are, at least in our culture, are socialized to be autonomous. And autonomy is a very big part of creation and creative work. Another thing that I think is interfering with women is really, in spite of all of our feminist freedoms, women have the main responsibility of raising the family. And it's the case that many women cannot indulge in their creative work or their creative careers until after the children are out of the family or at least old enough to take care of themselves partially. And this isn't only the way they're socialized, there's a biological aspect to this as well. Oxytocin, for instance, which is a neurochemical that makes mothers want to mother. And that's the most important thing in their life when the children are young, is taking care of those kids. And they have to put aside their creative work.
Now, that's on one hand. Yet, I'm sure you would argue that the advantage of being a woman is the range of your emotional self compared to most men's lack of range of their emotional self. And you believe, I believe from what I see in the book, that the emotionality can itself be used as a tool for your creativity. So if you got a much more emotional person or a person with many more emotions that they feel, it would seem that there's much more opportunity.
So I agree with that you can actually use your negative emotion states, including mild depression and anxiety, and you can transform that into positive work. Freud and psychoanalysts call this sublimation. So that's definitely the case that you can do that. But just having more emotions per se doesn't you can use emotions as fodder or subject matter for creative work, but that doesn't always translate into the ability to be more creative. Oftentimes, our emotions can get in the way of our creative efforts. Fear, for instance.
So how do the emotions get in the way? How about fear, for instance?
Well, I think that Kent was talking about this earlier, that people become afraid of the negative evaluation of others. So we have fear of failure. And highly creative people often realize that failure is part of the creative process. If you look at somebody like Thomas Edison, he tried 17 different ways to make a light bulb work. And he realized that failure is simply part of the process. Failing shows you how not to do something, and it shouldn't be something that you're afraid of. However, many people are afraid of failure, and they're afraid of looking silly in front of other people, and this keeps them from doing their creative work.
Wow, that's great.
You know, it seems like also that part of the apparent, you know, differences between the preparation stage, which seems to involve a very logical, sort of compulsive, strict sort of mindset, you know, to learn things, to study, to get information, seems to tap into a very, you know, compulsive, logical mind. But then the other part, which is a more freedom, spontaneous aspect of the coming to the solution. I think that those are very different sorts of parts of one's personality that very few people have hand in hand. You know, the ability at times to be very conservative and compulsive and learned, and then to not turn that off, but then tap into a kind of risk-taking, spontaneous, danger-seeking part of their personality.
Mm-hmm. Creativity for me is such a mixture of opposites and such a pushing and pulling. I mean, I know when, as I mentioned, my wife is a painter, and when I first met her, she would get up at, you know, 6:30 or 7 in the morning and go into her studio. And at about 11:30 or 12 o'clock at night, she'd be in her studio looking at what she had done for the day before she went to sleep. And I thought at the time, she's so marvelously disciplined. And then I got to know her a little better, and I realized that she was obsessed with what she was doing. This was her focus. For people to whom creativity is their livelihood, is who they are and what they do, it is a very, very powerful, almost obsessive force in their life. And it's the most important thing.
That's a real important question, Shelley. Have you found that if you're going to marry a creative person, get ready to be the third wheel? You know, is that really true? Because I think it must be. Because if you're with somebody who's producing and creating, you've got to be secondary. You can't say, "Hey, what about me? You're not paying attention to me. You're just down there writing that music and painting those paintings. Didn't you notice I got my hair cut?"
Well, going back to our male versus female talk that we were having a second ago, I do think that because women have to be or feel they have to be responsible for children, that oftentimes they don't feel their creative work can be the number one interest in their life until such time as they don't have to care for the children or if they have a nanny or whatever. But I would like to address this question of motivation, which I think is so interesting. Now, the people who are most creative are driven by what's called intrinsic motivation. And this is an internal reward for engaging in creative work. And we've actually found that there are some genetic influences that are associated with this, and it has to do with the response to novelty, the genes that are associated with novelty, which happen to be dopamine genes. Dopamine, by the way, is also the driving neurotransmitter in our reward center of our brain. So people who have a high response to novelty, that is, they are internally rewarded for responding to novelty, tend to have this intrinsic motivation, and it really does drive them. It's more important than fame, fortune, or other extrinsic types of rewards that they might get because it just feels so good. And I would like to just say one more thing about the biology of this, which I think is so interesting, is that your listeners may have heard of some of these stories of people with frontal temporal lobe dementia that became compulsive artists. And I actually have been corresponding with a man named Tommy McHugh, who lives over in Liverpool, England. And he became a spontaneous and obsessive artist after he had had a brain aneurysm in the prefrontal cortex. So what we're finding is this disinhibition thing again, that people who have disinhibition for one reason, whether it's physical or psychologically driven, are more intrinsically motivated to create.
Wow. Shelley, you also have in your book, on your interactive website, I know it exists, do you have a test that people could take?
Yes. So what I've done in the book is I started out by talking about there are different brain activation states that highly creative people use, and our goal is to try to mimic those to enhance our own creativity. And I identified 7 of these brain activation states, which I call the Creates Brain Set Model. And you can actually go on my website and take a little test that will show you which of those brain activation states feels most comfortable to you, and I call that your mental comfort zone.
Could you just take us through those 7 states, as we, even though we won't answer them, and give you feedback?
Okay, well, there's the 7 that I've identified so far, and so I'm sure it will change. The connect brain set, and brain sets, by the way, are sort of biological equivalents of mindsets. You know how when you're in a different mindset, you actually see the world a little differently? Well, brain sets cause that as well, so that when you're in different brain activation sets, you may actually see the world differently and go about solving problems differently. The connect brain, and by the way, these brain sets, oh, very cleverly called, spell the word creates.
Oh.
So the first one, do you want me to go through them? So the connect brain set is a state that you would be in when you're generating multiple solutions to a particular problem. This is when associational networks are activated, and you might sort of equate it with a hypomanic state. The R is for reason, and this is when you are solving problems in a logical and reasonable and sequential way. E is for envision, and this is primarily a state where you are using mental imagery and imagination to generate ideas. A is the absorb brain set, and actually we found that highly creative people spend a lot of time here. And it's a state of non-judgmental absorption and the ability just to be in the moment and see what's around you in a non-judgmental way. T is transform. This is what I was talking about earlier, when you can take negative energy, negative mood states, and transform them into creative work. E, the second E, is for evaluate. And this is when you have the judgment centers of your brain turned on and you are able to evaluate your work. And S is for stream, and stream is like a flow state or being in the zone where it seems that your actions are flowing without you're really consciously directing them.
Wow, beautifully done. So people could look at that by going to www.shelleycarson, that's S-H-E-L-L-E-Y, carson.com. The name of the book is Your Creative Brain, by Shelley Carson. I really appreciate that, Shelley, because I think you've given a lot of people food for thought. Kent Robert Shore, I want to thank you for being with us today. And Bill Astwood, thank you as well.
Always a pleasure.
Yes, yes.
So, dear my friends, go explore yourself just a little further. We'll be back with you. We'll be back with you soon, my friends. So I want to thank you, Shelley.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Sure. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind here on WBAI. One of the things that we do have, that we feel really lucky to have, is to have enough creativity to always look at the world in a different way. And maybe with a little help from people like Shelley Carson, we could learn a little more. I ran into a young man the other day. He said to me, "Armand, you're easy to talk to." And I said to him, "That's because I'm stupid." And he said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, you see, the smart people give you all the troubles." And then he said to me, he said, well, you're right. All those smart people are always trying to teach me. He said, does that mean I'm stupid too? And I said to him, I hope so.
Your mind is a beautiful piece of engineering. It's been said that if you do what you've always done, you're going to get what you always got. Here's a chance to learn new ways to be with people and to be with yourself as well. Tune into The Positive Mind, Tuesdays and Wednesdays at 1 p.m. on WBAI 99.5 FM. It's knowledge from the heart, my friends.
Gonna make it. I know we will.
We may have
to fight hardships alone.